I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now the Open Spaces Arts Festival is bringing in artists from all over the world to immerse themselves in the Kansas City landscape. I'm from here. I've lived most of my life here. And I think it's cool to get a fresh look at my own town through the eyes of people who don't live here, especially when they're artists, because artists tend to see things a little differently. Today, we're going to talk to Samford Biggers. He's based out of New York City. He's a multimedia performance artist, and he's very into Afrofuturism, which we will hear about. Hi, Samford Biggers.
Hello, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing okay.
Can you start by explaining your project in Kansas City, what you're doing on October 5th?
Yes, I will be doing a musical conceptual art performance with my sound project called Moon Medicine.
So tell us about Moon Medicine, first of all.
So Moon Medicine started probably a little over a decade ago when I assembled together a bunch of my friends who are usually, you know, mostly from the music world and the poetry world, and we started a collective. And we've done several projects over the last decade in Warsaw, Poland, New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Miami, and so on. And our present configuration, which I like to jokingly call a boy band, is comprised of four other performers, including myself: Martin Luther, who is the lead singer guitarist, Jahi Sundance, who is the turntablist, Swiss Chris on drums, Andre Simone, the original bass player for Prince's original first four albums, yes.
Wow.
Is playing bass for us, and Mark Hines is our sort of all-around technical AV guru.
In Kansas City, you're doing a performance in the American Jazz Museum, and I'm really interested in what made you want to work with that location?
Well, yes, I should give you a little background. I actually did a very large project in Kansas City in 2007 at Grand Arts. And as part of that installation, I had two pieces on site at Grand Arts, and then a third piece that was actually projected from the Jazz Museum across the street on a large wall in an open lot.
And the wall, it was like a brick wall, right?
It was a brick wall, exactly. And that was a video that I called Shusher, which depicted black men of various professions wearing the clothes of their trade. So you had a lawyer, a doctor, an artist, a DJ, all climbing up trees, getting comfortable and hanging out in the trees as opposed to being hung by them. And if you drove by, you could tune into a radio station that was actually playing the soundtrack. So in essence, it was a sound and video installation, but you could drive by and appreciate and view it.
So this is not the first time you've taken an interest in this spot. And it seems like your interest has to do with people who might have lived in this neighborhood, but I'm not sure. And I'm curious, you know, what is it that speaks to you about this place and it and the story it tells?
I think it's largely about the sort of history of music and that district having such a prominent position in the African-American community for so many years. And by doing projects there, it's in some ways sort of reliving and pointing to those accomplishments and those moments, but at the same time, creating new ones to go along with the legacy of that.
I mean, when you have come here before and in getting ready for your October performance, you've spent a lot of time there. What are some of your observations about the sort of present tense of 18th and Vine, the Jazz District in general, and even the museum itself?
Well, you know, it's as many other cities in the U.S. right now are going through some major changes as new communities are moving in and older communities are moving out, and it's usually a bit of a challenge. So I think I see it here in New York, I've seen it in Chicago, I've seen it in Los Angeles. I think it's very important to keep the history alive in these places so that it doesn't just get wiped out with the incoming populations. So I think that's part of it. Yeah, I think that's really much, you know, like I said, it's sort of a legacy piece in a way.
Before, when you were talking about the previous piece you had done where you had projected images of African-American men climbing trees to get comfortable and hang out as opposed to being lynched, do you see that as a dream or a present-day reality or a new spin on history? How do you understand where the images that you are projecting fit into our reality?
Well, I think reality is an interesting word. When I made that piece, I was actually thinking partially of surreality, you know, a surreal image to contradict the image of seeing black bodies hanging. In this case, it was black bodies hanging out. And, you know, I call the piece Cheshire, so there is a tongue-in-cheek reference to Lewis Carroll's Cheshire Cat from Alice in Wonderland, and how the Cheshire Cat appears and disappears. And this image of these black men in the trees sort of being visible as a potential for America, for the U.S., but at the same time often invisible because of the atrocities that are that black men are confronted with.
In your time in Kansas City, I mean, has the time that you've spent here given you some context for the kinds of issues you explore and how people here tend to talk about them? You're from originally Los Angeles. You live in New York now. I just can't help but assume that the conversation about race in Kansas City is not totally identical to those.
Right. And, you know, to be honest with you, the way we are doing this performance is we will actually be in the city for a week leading up to it. And that's really when we're planning to get out and talk to people and be part of the community in the sense to figure out exactly what those nuances are in the city right now. Because my reportage is from 10 years ago, and these things are changing yearly, if not monthly. I noticed that in Los Angeles and New York alone, so I know it's very similar in Kansas City.
Sanford, you were just saying that your sense of how Kansas Cityans talk about race comes mostly from the time you spent here 10 years ago. Take me back to that time, what you observed about us, how we relate to our own history, including our jazz history, our music history.
Well, I mean, I spent a lot of time abroad, and while away, there's always been this fascination with the music coming from the Midwest and the South. So I think part of my interest came from that. It's a bit of a romanticism on some way, but at the same time, the music that people enjoy that's coming from these areas is more than music for the people who live in these areas. These are opportunities for advancement. It's part entertainment for a local community, but at the same time, it's an avenue of getting out of a local community and becoming well-known worldwide and so on. So going back to that, I think in some ways I see that as an every story for small black towns throughout the U.S. And I know this is sort of a little bit of a stretch, but some of my visual work deals with patchwork, and I consider that part of the patchwork history, musical history of the U.S.
Can you say more about that word patchwork?
Sure. I use patchwork in my visual pieces using antique patchwork quilts and then painting over them. But I also consider that to be one of the modus operandi of Moon Medicine as a performance group. We take some covers and some original songs. We rearrange the covers, change the lyrics from time to time. So in essence, we are making a patchwork sonically, you know, through sampling and the mashup of songs that usually are not considered to be in the same set list. For example, there may be a Radiohead song juxtaposed with a John Coltrane song, juxtaposed with a Moon Medicine song. So it creates interesting patchwork combinations.
What do you see the whole patchwork concept doing for you and your ability to communicate some larger truth?
Because for me, it becomes a non-hierarchical way of using material. So in some way, I don't prioritize, let's say, one specific material as better or more valuable than another. I could use gold and I can use dirt, and I could put them together and somehow, I guess, neutralize the meaning of each one or combine them in a way that creates a different effect. So patchwork for me is sort of, you know, once again, I use the word modus operandi. It's a way of approaching materials in a way where they can come together and create new possibilities.
If you were a painter or a sculptor, I think people might be able to just picture a little more immediately what it is you do. And so I want to help people with a few examples. And
sure.
Filtered through this sort of observation that you really take people on journeys where there's something they experience at first and then something else kind of emerges later as a surprise. Can you talk to me about one of your previous Kansas City projects, a lotus flower etching?
Yes. So at Grand Arts several years ago, I did a very large glass disc. It was around 7.5 feet in diameter. and it was hanging in the center of a room by itself. And I call the piece Lotus because from a distance, it does look like a lotus blossom. I have studied Buddhism, so the lotus symbol is very important to me. And in this sense, you know, it becomes a mandala and a lotus blossom. But the closer you get to it, you realize that each of the petals of this lotus are actually cross sections of slave ships. And these were derived from diagrams by 18th century, 19th century slavers who were creating these diagrams to show how to best package human cargo. So from a distance, it's a very seductive, beautiful piece. But the closer you get, you start to see that it's really describing something quite horrific. And I think that's sort of the dichotomy that being in the U.S. sort of is. It's bittersweet. On some level, very beautiful and full of potential. On another level, still getting over its past and still finding ways to fully integrate its communities.
There was also a piano with a tree coming up out of it, and it would start to play a very well-known song very suddenly when people got close.
Sure. Yes, this the piece you're referring to was called Blossom. And it is a baby grand piano with a full-size sculpted tree growing right through the piano, literally lifting it up off of its feet as it bursts through and blossoms in the exhibition space. And as viewers get close to it, the sensors go off and you start to see the pedals moving and the keys moving, and it plays my personal rendition of the Billie Holiday and Abe Mirapool jazz standard, Strange Fruit.
What is it that you're hoping people experience when they go through this this journey, really, from something that seems maybe a little bit unusual but not particularly dangerous or unsettling, and then this other thing emerges, whether it's this etching of a slave ship or a song about lynching?
Well, I think what I want is the viewer to have a visceral reaction to the work. And I don't do that through shock. I actually do that through what I consider a slow reveal or multiple reveals. So there is the initial sense of seduction or awe in seeing a piano with a tree bursting through it or this beautiful glass flower with the light shining through it. And that brings you closer. And then the closer you get, you start to feel something is a little bit off or not quite as comforting as you might have initially thought in the beginning. So when you start to hear the music come out and you start to hear this version of Strange Fruit, or you start to see the slave ships in the lotus diagram, you start to sense that there is a deeper story. And then you go into reading the title, and that gives a little bit more information. And then if you are the kind that likes to do research like myself, if you look up my work, you sort of see a whole trajectory, a good 20 years of work that has these myriad meanings, and they all compound with each other to create, you know, I guess a treatise of some sort. One of the things I was thinking about when getting this performance together for Kansas City is that the pieces I did prior at the Grand Arts Institution were based on Blossom, which was a sound piece with a sculpture. And there was the video piece, of course, that was in the Jazz District. And this performance seems like the next iteration of all of those. So it's, in fact, a real performance that is part sculptural and part art performance, but also part musical experience. So it's sort of the next leap from going from objects that play music and videos that imply music to actually having the music presentation with the video and the performative element.
We'll hear more about what inspires Samford Biggers in all his work in a few minutes. I'm Gina Kaufman talking to a big deal artist from New York. His name is Samford Biggers, and he's coming to town for a happening at 18th and Vine. That'll be October 5th. We've been talking about how his projects usually appear one way from afar and then take a surprising turn when you get close up. So he'll lure you in before having you confront something challenging. And Samford, I love that aspect of your work, but I wonder if you felt like you have to start out with something a little more comfortable to get people to deal with things like race.
I don't feel that I necessarily have to do that, but I am a formalist and I do believe in you know, the ideas of beauty and for lack of a better word, seduction. I think art should compel someone to look for a long time. Now, when I say beauty, don't get me wrong. I don't mean just pretty images. I mean something that is attractive, even if it's a little off-putting, but something visually that brings, that magnetizes a viewer to get closer and then invest the time to actually read a little bit deeper into the piece. I'm not interested in anything being a one-liner or being easily stated or defined. I'm more interested in the viewer, like you said, going on a journey to experience and understand the different meanings. Once again, it's not just one meaning that comes out of this work. The audience brings their own experience and interpretations, and that is very important too.
Why do you think that art is the way that you prefer to communicate about these things that clearly matter to you a lot and that that people can communicate about and do communicate about in a lot of ways, but you do it through art?
Well, I think visual art has a different rate of revealing itself and for people to understand it. And in a sense, I think it takes people and puts them a little bit off guard because they don't know how to perceive it. It's not as simple as just listening to something or just reading something. They really have to tap into their own intuition and discern different ideas, elements, and meanings and symbols from the work. So I think that visual arts works very differently than these other modes of communication. And for me, I think that mystery is important.
Can you tell me a little bit more about how you developed this whole multimedia, multisensory thing you do? When people become painters or sculptors, even just straightforward musicians, there is kind of a precedent for what that looks like, how you do it, and honestly, who funds it, who supports it. The path is a lot less clear with the kind of thing you do.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't really intentional. I think, you know, just a little background, I began learning piano by ear as a very young child, and I used to sit for hours with the radio on and just play the songs that I would hear, and that's how I taught myself how to, you know, be a musician. But by the time I became a young teen and started listening to jazz music, I could no longer play it. I couldn't read it, and I couldn't pick it up just by ear. So out of frustration, I started painting pictures of the people I was listening to. And as I did that, I realized that many of my friends had no idea who these figures were, and I would explain, oh, this might be Duke Ellington, or this could be Aretha Franklin at that point, you know. And it was a way of communication. So over the years, I've sort of really follow my intuition when it comes to an idea. And some ideas present themselves better in paint. Sometimes they present better in video, sometimes in sound. And I use that analogy to a patchwork. My process is a patchwork. So I combine all those media to get to the idea that I want to put forward.
Talk to me about the teenager who was into all these jazz greats, but who his friends had never heard of.
Well, I had, you know, the benefit of having a brother and sister who were almost a decade older than me. So they were listening to genres of music that I was not yet introduced to. But of course, wanting to be older than I was, I would sneak and listen to them when they weren't looking or when they were hanging out with their friends. I'd hang out outside and try to put my ear to the door to hear what was going on as they were listening to Richard Pryor records or James Brown or Miles Davis. And then they were also listening to funk and all of those things. And that was before, you know, the music of my generation was coming out, which was sort of like the new wave and then later hip hop, of course. I'm sorry. Did I answer your question? I forgot what
the question
was. Well,
kind of. I just am curious about, the human being who does this stuff a little bit and that moment of being a teenager who is listening to music that his peers are not seemed maybe like a key.
As a teenager, I mean, I came from a close-knit family, and my parents, as well as my brother and sister, who are around a decade older than me, would play their music on the record player where we could all hear it. And then as they got older and had their own rooms and their own record players, I would sneak around and hang outside their room to listen to what they were listening to with their friends. So I was exposed to a lot of music that was of a generation or two above me. And that sort of, I guess, educated me in terms of music. And when hip-hop came around, I was totally invested in it in terms of rapping and breakdancing and doing graffiti and DJing. I did pretty much all of them except the rapping.
And you did all of those in L.A.?
Oh, yeah. This was L.A., and, you know, it hadn't hit that hard yet in L.A., so we would go to one record store that sold 12-inch, you know, vinyls from New York or from the East Coast. So we were able to actually listen to East Coast hip-hop, which was a huge thing. It was very rebellious in L.A. at that time because L.A. wasn't there yet. And, you know, also looking at movies like Beach Street and Wild Style and doing graffiti. So a group of friends of mine, we were doing graffiti on, you know, in the train tracks and so on until I finally got busted and got the fear of God in me, basically, and turned to oil painting and probably
much
a month
safer.
Much safer. Around a month after being busted by the cops, I was in AP art classes doing portraits.
When you talk about this patchwork in your art being this kind of equalizer in a way of the of materials that we put a different kind of value on based on all kinds of baggage we bring to it. So you were using gold and dirt as the example. But when you talk about jazz and hip hop and graffiti and oil painting, there is an analogy there.
You're saying there's an analogy between those materials and the gold and the dirt?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, I've always been a fan of quote unquote high and low culture mixing. And because I actually don't believe there is a high and a low culture. I think it's just culture. And I like to play with the power that's vested in those interests. So context is even important to me. Where the works end up being shown or how they're shown also connotes those issues of power and priority and high and low culture.
You're known for your work with Afrofuturism, and I've heard other people define that term, but I'd love to hear what Afrofuturism means to you.
I am so sorry. I think I'm probably going to let you down. I sort of stopped using the phrase Afrofuturism quite some time ago.
Why?
Well, at that point it was futuristic, but when it became a catchphrase, it no longer was. So, you know, when the labels come out, that's usually when you have to start finding something else, another way of speaking about it. That's not to diss anything or anyone in the Afrofuturist realm. I think it's a very important genre. But I do think Afrofuturism can be a conundrum once it becomes mainstreamed.
Explain that.
Like I said, I think the Afrofuturist dialogue has been going on actually since the 60s, if not before. So here we are in 2018, and in the last 3 or 4 years, it's become a huge buzzword. But I remember, you know, obviously we could talk about Sun Ra or Coltrane or Octavia Butler or all these people who were working in the genre 20, 30 years ago. So it seems ironic that we're calling it Afrofuturism. Maybe it's an Afro-postmodernism.
Like we're already in the future now?
Yeah, we're already in the future. And, you know, we're in the future, we're in the past and the present. You know what I mean? I think we're sort of in all those spaces at once.
When you think about what Afrofuturism did mean, how would you explain that?
I think it was a way of trying to understand the African diasporic experience outside of the language that was typically used at that time and outside of the images that were typically shown at that time. And when I say shown, I mean mainstreamed. So we needed an alternative way of talking about our experience that you could not find on the news, that you could not find in magazines and newspapers or in representations in TV and cinema. So it was a new aesthetic and a new understanding of the African diasporic experience.
And now it does not feel like a new understanding to you?
I think it's still unfolding. My issue is just with the label. Like I said, the genre itself, I think, is totally valid and valuable. But it's the labeling that I find problematic.
So
do you want me to go on?
Yeah, I do.
Well, I just think that once labels get put on, marketing follows. And when marketing follows, that means something has now been usurped, mainstreamed, and sometimes taken away or detached from its initial sense of rebellion and power.
So it's kind of a marketing tool?
It can be, yes.
When I think about the location that you've now chosen more than once to work in Kansas City, the 18th and Vine Jazz District, and particularly in this case, at the American Jazz Museum, I think this whole idea of a rebellious moment, but one that lives in the past, feels really poignant when I think about that. With the 18th and Vine District that that we think about when we maybe romanticize the past versus the 18th and Vine District that people will actually be setting foot in when they come to your performance?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, I guess this sort of goes back into what we were saying about Afrofuturism, is that we are in a we're always in a convergence of past, present, and future. So for me, it's less important to delineate those things and constantly remind ourselves about those histories, pasts, and potential futures so that we don't lose sight and we don't lose grounding. It's very easy to pave over a neighborhood. It's very easy to put a new sign on a building. And then what does that really do to the history? And I think the U.S. is particularly susceptible to historic amnesia. And I think there are powers out there that are promoting historic amnesia for convenience sake. And I and many of my friends are here to combat that. I think we have a rich myriad patchwork history that should always be remembered.
When you come here for an October 5th performance, I know that the week leading up to that is going to be where a lot of that work happens. Can you tell me more about what you do know, what you are hoping to get at, what you are hoping will happen?
Well, you know, we will be rehearsing in the Jazz District, and we're hoping to have interactions with people who want to come by and check out our rehearsal sessions, also spending time and going to different local establishments in the district and outside of the district, too, in Kansas City in general, so we have a better understanding and have more chance encounters with people, which more than likely will inform the performance. We are a pretty responsive group. So if we get there and we see there's a conversation that's happening that feels like it needs to be addressed somehow or entered into the performance, that actually will happen. So we go there sort of as sponges to experience and hear and then find ways to interpret that.
Do you know specifically where you might be hanging out being a sponge?
No, not yet. So I am totally interested for suggestions.
Now I'm on the spot. There, Kansas City has many wonderful hangouts. Maybe I'll send you a little note when we get off the air about that.
That'd be fantastic.
Before we go, can you tell me a little bit more about how you plan to interact with the audience? Because I understand that the audience will be part of the performance, that it's not such a clear delineation of like performer and over here and audience over there.
Right, yeah. Well, without, you know, spoiling the surprises we have in store for the audience, we do like to sort of blur the lines between performance and happening, and the line between performer and audience. So, you know, you might find part of the band in the audience for part of the performance. You might find that there's images of the audience being played back directly in real time, yet the context seems different. So it sort of becomes like a meta performance. And, you know, with various technological means and performative means, there's ways to do that so that it feels like an art piece. And it feels not just like a group looking at another group performing, but somehow a participation amongst all of us.
In your experience using this format, how do you have any funny stories about how people have responded?
We did a performance at the legendary nightclub called The Box in New York City, and we did several things that included the audience, but finally at the end of the piece, rather than coming out and taking a bow, the entire cast came out holding mirrors and stood there with mirrors. So while the crowd was clapping and they gave their ovation, ultimately they were clapping at themselves and giving themselves the ovation because they could not see us as we were all hiding behind mirrors that we were holding. So once again, that was one of those reflexive moments when the line was blurred between the audience and the performers.
It must feel good to give yourself a standing ovation and be like, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and darn it, people like me.
Exactly.
Well, Sanford Biggers, I am really excited to catch this performance and excited that you had some time to talk to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and Sanford Biggers has been our guest today. His performance with Open Spaces is coming up October 5th. I hope you enjoyed our conversation, and I really will be sending him some thoughts about where to hang out when he's in town. If you've ever gone somewhere fun or interesting thanks to this show, call in now. It's our fall membership drive, and we are so grateful for your support.